You're listening to the Mormon Theories Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Hinckley. So my guest today is my friend Gabe Arichu. He's a chiropractor and a functional medicine doctor. We talk a little bit about health, about the word of wisdom, about evolution, about the fall of Adam and Eve, and a little bit about how to become a great syncretizer like Joseph Smith. I really love this conversation. I think you'll love it too. It's super useful. I hope you like it. Please know, as you listen, that the views of my guests on the podcast do not necessarily reflect my own beliefs or the official doctrine of any denomination, including the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And with that, enjoy the show.
Hey, Gabe. How are you doing, man? Welcome to the podcast.
Doing awesome, man. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'm excited to talk to you today. So I kind of want to let you introduce yourself. I know you have a pretty cool story as far as how you learned about the gospel and got into all this stuff. And so can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So I grew up essentially Pentecostal/Baptist/non-denominational. My mom is Pentecostal. My dad grew up Greek Orthodox. He's from Romania. That's where I get my fun last name. So he married my mom, converted to Pentecostalism, and then we moved to Missouri from California. And so I kind of grew up in a very small town in Missouri, so very much kind of Southern evangelical type ideals. We went to like an Assemblies of God growing up, and then after a while we stopped going. And then in high school, because of a girl, I started going to a Baptist church and joined them. I think it was Baptist. I don't really know. It's not like we were really taught certain principles, certain doctrines, but very much baptized, been kind of went through kind of the motions. Heard the same sermon like three Sundays in a row, and that's where I started getting my disillusionment. I was just like foreseeing a future of constant same sermons.
Yeah.
And so I was like, no, I'm done. And so I kind of went back to doing what I usually do with all my friends, went into the party lifestyle, especially when college hit. There were a few members of the church in my high school. Like there's a local building, even though there's like 3,000 people in the town, there was a meeting house there. So I had a couple friends in high school that were members interested in one, cause she brought like a Book of Mormon to class and set it on the table. And I was like, what's this? And I just pick it up. And she was shocked that I would just pick it up. And I was like, is this just like the New Testament? And she's like, yeah. And then that was the end. I was like totally open if she wanted to share something.
Yeah.
And then my good friend, who's still a really good friend to this day, he's the one that ended up baptizing me. I was just like, dude, I want to go to your church sometime. He never followed up on it. And so I definitely get at him every time with that one. So I go to college, fall into this, like my house was like a frat house. It was horrible. And went into just kind of just horrible stuff, and life went to crap. And I ended up just praying to God one day. I was just like, this sucks. Life isn't good. It was kind of the hinge point of me changing. And so I ended up at some point just kind of sobering up to myself in multiple ways. And leaving behind everything. And then my friend from high school just happened to pop on, like back then, MSN Messenger.
Oh yeah, I remember. Oh yeah. That.
And I was just like, what are you doing? We went to the same university. We were going to Missouri State. Okay. He's just like, oh, I'm going to actually have a missionary booth on campus. You should drop by. So I dropped by, saw him. There was like sister missionaries there and stuff. And so I ended up actually helping them pass along cards and stuff. Just because I was just having fun with everyone.
Cool.
Skipped class. They gave me a Book of Mormon, asked me to read and pray. Totally don't remember this, but one of the sisters afterwards told me, like, you said you would never read. You just kind of took it and left. But it was such a good experience that I was just like, okay, what is this book? And so I just, while I was in my car, I prayed to know if it was true. And the Spirit overwhelmed me, like even before I read it, and just said, I knew it was true, just complete joy. Yeah. And so from there on, I didn't miss a meeting. I went to Institute. I went to every single thing that was involved with the church and completely did a 180 in my life. So that's kind of how, where I came from. That's essentially the story of me joining the church.
That's awesome.
I went on a 2-year mission. I didn't think I was going to. I wanted to right off the bat because, you know, fire the convert type stuff.
Yeah.
But then everyone just kept getting on my back about it. And I got annoyed. And then there was a girl involved and I got further annoyed with people asking. And so I finally just said no. My bishop or branch president at the time was very, very patient and never really pushed at all, which is exactly what I needed. Though I remember reading one time after I got the Melchizedek priesthood, I read a quote by Elder Groberg in the New Era, and it said, it is mandatory for all Melchizedek priesthood holders to serve a mission. I was like, I didn't sign up for that. And so my year mark in the church came around. So I had a lot of friends that did shows in Branson. So if anyone's unfamiliar with Branson, it's like Las Vegas without all the gambling and whatnot.
Okay.
It's just lots of variety shows and stuff. And so they had a show and I went there, and during some point during it, the Spirit just overwhelmed. It's like, you need to go on a mission. And I was like, okay. So I just started preparing there. And so I served in South Africa, Cape Town.
Nice.
Mission.
That's so awesome.
From 05 to 07.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of my story in a nutshell. I mean, there's obviously a lot more that we're going to get into and how
right
thoughts and ideas have developed.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's good. Good for you. I've always wanted to go to Africa, but I've never made it there.
Oh, that's amazing. I didn't even think about it as an opportunity for my mission. Like, I thought all my friends were going to South America or somewhere in California, so I just assumed. And then, you know, I get the call and I'm like slightly disappointed because it wasn't that.
Yeah.
And then I was like, but South Africa, that's interesting. That's cool.
That's awesome.
And so yeah, no, I love Africa. I think about it every day.
Yeah, that's so cool. Awesome. Yeah, well, thanks for sharing that. I know you just through Facebook, essentially. Like, this is the first time we've talked face to face, and it's still over the internet, so it's
yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, but
I mean, other than we having a mutual friend apparently that I was going to church with and chiropractic school with.
yeah I saw that after the fact, which is kind of interesting, but yeah,
weird.
Yeah. So the reason we became friends was that we were commenting on some post of someone, and you helped me to figure out where I could find some better food for my family, like a local farm, right? I don't know if you remember this.
Yeah, with therealmilk.com or whatever.
Yeah, and so I went to that website. We found one just like 30 minutes down the road. And we've been buying milk from there ever since. Awesome. And I was like, man, this guy's awesome. And so you seemed really knowledgeable. And then I found out later that your job has a lot to do with health. And so I'd like for you to talk to us about that, and maybe talk a little bit about the nutrition and the word of wisdom or whatever. We can get into all that. So
sounds good. So my job, so technically I'm a licensed chiropractor, but if most people, whenever they come to see me, if they don't understand what I do, they're going to think traditional chiropractic, what you typically see on TV or what you've had experience with, cracking the back, that sort of thing. I'm very much don't do that. Like, that's, I have a license in chiropractic. Doesn't mean I don't care about the musculoskeletal side, the structural support. I just do it differently than most. So the whole idea, so I first, my whole plan career-wise after I got home from my mission was to do seminary and institute. And life took a 180, went downhill, lots of bad things. And I ended up foregoing that because, well, I went through a divorce. And so at the time, you weren't allowed. And so I went home, started thinking about a PhD in theology, but felt more and more compelled to go a different direction. I had a friend that was the guy that baptized me. He's an RN, or now a nurse practitioner. So I went to nursing school thinking, okay, I'll become a nurse practitioner. that would be a very helpful thing. But while I was in nursing school, they changed it to being a doctorate. And so I was like, that's, why would I want to go be a doctor and not have the privileges that other doctors have? So I started looking into med school. And while I was doing that, one of my buddies, who's actually my wife's cousin, my now wife, he said, let's go shadow a chiropractor. I've never been to a chiropractor, I think, at that point. Well, maybe I went to one once, but didn't really think about it. I was like, sure, let's go do it. And it happened to be a bishop of one of our wards. And so went and talked to him, and it was like, yeah, this is it. It's what I was looking for. It was much more non-interventional, because I didn't want to intervene too much. It wasn't my thing. And I thought, if I could just help people move better, they would feel better and overall live a better and healthier life. And I really cared about getting to like nutrition and other things, but I felt like I could do that on the side type of thing, just be a little bit of an interest. It wasn't super important to me as of yet, to the degree that it now is. So my mom's diabetic. So that was always a concern for me. And that was one of the driving forces. The other driving force was I, since high school, dealt with migraines. So in high school, I'd get them once in a while. On my mission, a couple of times, I can't remember exactly how many times I got them. And then when I got home, it progressively got worse to the point that I was getting migraines almost every day. And the only thing I could do was take caffeine. And that would keep it at bay if I caught it early enough. And usually it was Excedrin. So I'm sure my liver is incredibly happy with the years and years of Excedrin. And so I was hoping that chiropractic would solve this problem, as well as just helping me learn how to help people in general. So I got into chiropractic school and get my first adjustments for my neck and stuff, where they're just popping your neck, and it actually caused migraines. So wasn't helpful at all.
Yeah.
And it was really hard. And then the second trimester, so my class was weird. It was unique. So I went to chiropractic school in St. Louis. We had we were a summer class. So it goes by trimesters instead of semesters. So each class is kind of unique. You stay with them the entire time unless they fail back. And so it was a class of about 30 some kids, 40 kids, and a third of them were Latter-day Saints, just wow. Random, mm-hmm. But it was cool. But one of them was a guy that sat next to me. He was an older guy, had five kids already. One of them was on a mission or about to go. But he told me about a seminar that was being held. And so I went to the seminar or at least was starting to get involved with this stuff before the seminar. I think the seminar might've been a semester later, but it's something called applied kinesiology. And it's one of the main things that I do as a doctor. And it involves a neurologic test, muscle testing. So a lot of people are familiar with it if you got into a car accident or you went to like a PT or something like that, and they tested your muscles to see what exercises you might need. But it became a much broader, holistic way of evaluating the nervous system itself. And so we're able to test quite a few things off of that. Well, I went to the seminar and coming, like the guy asks, anyone have headaches? And I said, I got migraines. And he goes, come up here. And within 10, 15, 20 minutes, he narrowed it down to gluten being a problem. And so I was like, okay, we'll see. It was before gluten was a major fad that it is now. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, all right, we'll go off. And I went off of gluten, 3 weeks, no migraines. Wow. I haven't had that in forever.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I was still skeptical. So I had pizza. Sure enough, worse migraine next day. Mm. Horrible. And so I was like, okay, there's something here. And I still had some cognitive dissonance with the technique and stuff. But ultimately I couldn't deny that. And so that kind of led me down nutrition. My friend also introduced me at the same time as my wife's sister-in-law introduced me to a book called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston A. Price. So that realmilk.com, the one that I sent you, that's all Weston Price stuff. And so I read that book, super fascinating, done like over 100 years ago, where a guy, Weston Price, he's a dentist, went to, I can't remember how many indigenous populations around the world. So he went to the Maasai in Africa. He went to the Kitabis Islands and somewhere in Switzerland, just several different places. And so he just studied their traditional diet and what happened when they switched to a Western diet, from mainly dental health wise, but he showed, I don't know, thousands of pictures of these guys having perfect teeth. And then within one generation of the Western diet, completely ruined. And so that was fascinating to me. And that just led me down the Western Price side of things. Now this is going to start getting into the Word of Wisdom. Western Price matches up pretty well with the traditional view of the Word of Wisdom.
Okay.
I think. It depends on who you talk to within it.
Yeah.
And then the guy, my mentor, the guy who taught me and found gluten to be the cause, he's a massive paleo fan. So that's where he started introducing that. And me and my buddy who introduced me to all of this world, just started trying to figure out, how does this even fit in with Word of Wisdom? Like, if we can't eat any grains, that's all the Word of Wisdom talks about. What the heck? What do we do with that?
Staff of life, right?
Exactly. Staff of life. What do we do with that? And so I had major cognitive dissonance with that. And maybe this is important too, to interject. This is all my evangelical tradition, as well as just growing up where I grew up, starting to come to the forefront. And I brought all that into the church, because the church still has a lot of that, not the church itself, but the members of the church, mm-hmm. especially here in America, we hold to that. And so if anyone doesn't understand fundamentalism is what I'm talking about. It's this idea where we're essentially on a defensive posture against various things. So it started in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and really came to a head maybe like the 1950s, but it was a defense against a push from the secular world trying to tear apart religion. And so it actually was legitimate defense, but they became entrenched in traditional ideas that don't hold up at all. So like King James Version being the only authorized version is one, and the only one that's true. There's the idea of literalism. So you take the scriptures at face value, which I know Ben Spackman gets really mad at, because literalism from an academic sense means something completely different. Yeah. It means taking it from the original intent. And so it's very much reading things at face value. So if God pulled Adam or pulled Eve out of Adam from a rib, that's literally what happened. And so that's always just a fascinating thing, but that's my background coming into this. I was really interested in some of the more esoteric stuff, even whenever I was like going to the Baptist church. Like, I loved the Left Behind series, which is a huge evangelical thing out there about the rapture, which once I actually read the scriptures and realized there was no supporting evidence for that. And it came from like the 1850s, I think, is where the rapture came from. But it's this fascinating stuff to me, but I was deeply entrenched in that. And so that goes into my viewpoints that with the Word of Wisdom, because I read like so many things on my mission. So another tangent, I guess. When I was on my mission, me and a group of friends in our district got really into the study and whatever we could get our hands on. And so I tried to get approval from the mission president. I was like, hey, is it okay if I read this, this, or that in my downtime? So outside of the 2 hours you were required to study and whatnot, and outside of proselyting time. And he's like, yeah, that's fine. You can do that. And so, yeah, I read everything I could get my hands on. I felt very inadequate because everyone around me went through seminary. I didn't. Mm-hmm. So they're quoting stuff right and left. And I'm like, I got to study. I'm behind. And so by the end of my mission, I probably read like 50 or 100 books, whatever I could get on. Like, I read the entire work in the Glory series in like a single transfer.
Wow.
But I just grabbed everything I could, including like Elder McConkie's works. And then we had this group of MP3 discs that float around our mission that had all sorts of interesting talks and like some really good ones, like Hugh Nibley and Truman G. Madsen, some really, really good stuff. But then some weird stuff too. Like, I think one of the things had like the weird quotes about Jesus being married, Jesus being a polygamist, people living on the moon, all that weird stuff from the Journal of Discourses.
Yeah.
And so we're just like trying to figure out, how does this all fit in? Because we take the prophets literally.
Yeah.
They don't make mistakes. And right. So we're trying to figure out all that and reading Mormon doctrine. And one of my buddies had the first edition of Mormon doctrine. So we read that. And, you know, of course, we're just like, well, you know, it's not approved, but it is approved. That type of stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And so that kind of goes into my, the way that I view things. And so now I'm challenging paleo and the word of wisdom, and I'm trying to figure that out. And it, at some point it just came to a head. I'm just like, maybe it's just because we adulterated our food so much that the word of wisdom no longer can really fit. And that's where I became comfortable for a while. Mm-hmm. But then things just don't add up after a while. It just didn't fit that narrative. The cognitive dissonance was still there in the back of my mind. I was trying to figure it out. And of course we've talked about it, but like verse 15, I think in the word of wisdom, we read it as if it applies to beef again, or not beef, animals again.
Right.
It's just like, why is the Lord being redundant saying that you can't eat animal foods, or at least eat them sparingly, or only in times of famine and cold or that so on? Why is he being redundant in saying this again?
Yeah.
And it's all in the way that we're interpreting it. And so that's a huge problem too, because we Latter-day Saints don't interpret, right?
Yeah.
We don't interpret anything. Well, no, we interpret every time we're reading, and we interpret through our cultural biases and what we bring to the table.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, that's the fascinating thing with the word of wisdom. And so I've completely flipped on my views of the word of wisdom and how to approach it. At one point it was just, well, anything can fit in there. Like Ben Bickman from BYU, he talks about any diet can fit into it. And he argues that we are all, in a sense, sedentary, therefore living in a winter time frame. Therefore, we should eat more meat and be more along the keto framework. And of course, he argues that being an expert in insulin resistance and insulin research, that is what primarily we should be doing. We should be in a keto state all the time. Of course, there's people that argue strongly against that. Mm-hmm. And where does it really lie? And I held to that for a little while, that he was, you know, the idea that any diet can fit into it. And I think that's still generally true, but I think sometimes we're just trying to fit things into our traditional interpretation of scripture. And in reality, our interpretation is what needs to change. Our hermeneutics, what we're bringing to the table, our tools that we're using to interpret. Yeah. And so now I view it completely differently. Part of it was my transition away from that more evangelical fundamentalist mindset that I used to have. And I'm sure I still hold some of those things. But one thing was reading Spackman's website, and he talked about accommodation. And so accommodation is this idea that the Lord speaks to people at various times according to their culture and understanding. So he will accommodate to, let's say, the scientific reasoning of their age or their understanding, whether you want to call it science or not. So he uses the Hebrew cosmology, the Near Eastern cosmology, in the Old Testament to talk to them about it. And so he's laying out flat earth, and that's what is in the Bible, is a flat earth concept, but God isn't necessarily saying that is what legitimately is out there.
Yeah.
He's just using it to teach them something. And so that's where I've come to realize with the word of wisdom. The word of wisdom was given during the temperance movement era. And so everything we read in the word of wisdom is not that unique. It's, in fact, we can find it within the temperance movement. We can find it within Sylvester Graham's movement. There's just a big movement of various health reforms at that time. And so the accepted nutritional science at the time, if you want to call it that, is what we're reading in the temperance, or in the word of wisdom.
Okay.
And so for me, I just came to realize that. And I wonder if it's like Brigham Young. When Brigham Young, he said, there's a great quote from him about the Book of Mormon. He's like, if we were to retranslate, or the Lord was going to have us retranslate the Book of Mormon again, it would be remarkably different than what we currently have. I wonder if that would not be the same thing with the word of wisdom, if we were to receive a new revelation all over again on it, it would be remarkably different.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of my view with it. Not that it's not revelation. I think the Lord is giving us something that's very important, but I think it's significant that the brethren continue to only enforce the prohibitions. Right. So alcohol, tea, coffee, and so on. But he doesn't, the church doesn't really enforce anything else. And of course, it's become a tradition. You need to eat sparingly, but no one asks what the heck that means, and so on and so forth. So now I view it very, very differently, especially when we get into evolution. Okay. Because evolution is a huge concept here.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, I jabbered on for a while.
No, that's great. That's great. And we'll talk about evolution. I just want to make some comments. I think it is super important to understand that God will speak to us how we will understand it, right? And so your point that the word of wisdom was probably given to Joseph Smith because that was like the accepted science at the time and it would have made sense to them, that makes perfect sense. And so I wonder, like, it kind of made me think of what you said before, like back then in Joseph Smith's time, do you think that someone would have been better off like adhering more to like more plants, more grains than today because of the way the food's been adulterated? Like what are your thoughts on that?
Probably not. What we've learned since then, they do obviously have unadulterated certain foods. But then also they still practice a more traditional way of making those foods. So they were ahead of us with dealing with those foods, but to say necessarily that they would be better off, the only thing I would say that they'd be better off is having a lot less alcohol and tobacco, because there was a lot of alcohol use at that time. It was crazy when you go back and read how many gallons per person per year. It was a lot of alcohol. So that would be the biggest one for me. And especially when we even look at it today, we can't really see major health benefits. Like the studies that have been done out of like UCLA, when you make all the factors equal and try to see what's going on, it really is because Latter-day Saints fast once a month. That's something a doctor out of Toronto, a nephrologist, Jason Fung, he actually points it out that Latter-day Saints, well, the reason they're have a longer lifespan than most is they fast once a month. So he talks about the benefits of fasting. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about adhering to the word of wisdom as written, the Seventh-day Adventists actually do a much better job, which is kind of interesting. If we compare to the Seventh-day Adventists, it's very similar.
Yeah.
And they came out of the same time frame. So mm-hmm. they came out of the Millerite movement in the late 1840s or maybe mid 1840s. And then Ellen G. White continues on with that. But again, it's this coming from the same cultural river. Like I love that word or phrase from John Walton, who's a great evangelical scholar that we have currently. But he'll talk about it being the cultural river. So it's not that we're borrowing, it's just in the same cultural river and the Lord's using that to help teach us principles. And I think that's what we're trying to grab from the word of wisdom, is he's trying to teach us specific principles, and we can become overly concerned about something that, well, as Hugh Nibley talked about with the word of wisdom, we become very overly concerned with something that's temporal. It's not an eternal principle. It's not an eternal law. It won't matter in the next life. Right. Especially when you're resurrected, it's not going to really matter too much.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting thing. The other thought that came to my head was we take kosher law. I think sometimes we take God just gave them that, yeah. But we don't really think about what was happening at the time. So I have some interesting friends who are Messianic Jews. And so one of my mentors is one of them. And one of my good friends, I order herbs from them. And so that's the herbs that I use to give to patients. But they have some interesting views on some of the things like what we think are as leprosy in the Old Testament is most likely maybe a fungal issue. And so by exiling them out of the camp and clearing out their tent, it would kill it. And so it is actually a very helpful practice. But I go on, I just brought them up just as a tangent, but I read recently something about the pigs and how pork was actually really common in the pre-exilic period at some point, and then it became not popular when the Philistines came in because they were big pig eaters. And so it was almost like a cultural pushback against them. That could have been what led to the pork prohibition. And it had less to do with this divine command that porks are horrible or pigs are horrible for us.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting thing. And it would be, again, accommodation. And then the last accommodation I always bring up when I try to teach it is circumcision. Circumcision was well known and practiced before Abraham. And it, God clearly took it and then gave it to Abraham as a principle to live by, but changed its meaning to be something more meaningful for Abraham and his children. So yeah, there's some ideas.
Yeah. So if you don't mind me asking, do you feel like you, the diet that you kind of eat right now, mostly, do you feel like that can be in line with the word of wisdom?
So it depends on how you look at the word of wisdom. I think so. I think it can be in line, but it really just depends on interpretation. So if you interpret it how I'm interpreting it as the best that we could give at that time, then yes. Or if we interpret it as the way that the church teaches currently, whenever we ask the temple recommend question, do you obey the word of wisdom? We're talking about those five things: no drugs, no alcohol, tea, coffee, tobacco. That's all we're talking about. And so in that line, absolutely. But I know for some people, they'd be like, no, that doesn't match. But then it depends on how, again, you're interpreting the word wisdom. It depends on that little comma that's in there that's caused so much flack over the years, whether or not we should only eat them in times of cold and famine, or don't only eat them in times of cold and famine. Right. But also, what does it mean by prudence? Like you, I remember reading a post by you on prudence and how important that is when it's applied to vegetables and fruit. And then what does it mean to eat meat with Thanksgiving, as it says in what, Doctrine and Covenants 48? I can't remember the other one.
49, but maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. But the sparingly, what does sparingly mean? So one of the meanings at that time of sparingly was just to spare God's creatures. So don't go out and kill them all. And that's another huge important thing that we have overlooked, that since the 1500s up until Joseph Smith's time, it was no holds bar, kill any animal you see on site for fun, for game, for sport, because they're pests, whatever. Mm-hmm. We butchered so many animals that it was just madness. Like if there was a squirrel running across, it was common for people just to shoot it for no reason,
yeah,
other than that it was a pest. And so if we take it literally that, you know, God cares about the earth as a gardener, as his creation, I think that becomes a very important part.
Yeah.
Especially if we see the light of Christ is in and through all things. I mean, it may not be a good idea to just go kill everything without any gratitude, and to actually use the entire animal. Because when we talk about sparingly, let's say you take down a ruminant. So whether what was more common back then, elk, moose, bison, take down a bison, how long is that meat going to last you? And then, of course, the question of storage is a big one. I think that's still a legitimate question on refrigeration and whatnot. But the people of that era weren't dumb. They knew how to preserve meat. They knew that they could dry it. They could do all sorts of things. They can make pemmican, which can last for a long time. There's ways around that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I think sparingly has more to do with just don't go kill everything.
Right.
I think it just depends on your interpretation. But yes, I do believe that the way I live is in line with God's way of thinking.
Yeah. I love, I'm sure it is. I love what you said about sparingly, like that. I never thought about it that way before. Before you said that, my family, me and my wife and my son, we've maybe bought the equivalent of one cow over like the last year and a half or so. Right.
Yeah.
And That's it. Like, if you think about it, only one cow has had to die to kind of keep us alive for a year and a half. And so,
and then compared to the chickens that people eat today.
Yep.
I think that's a huge thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you kill so many chickens just to feed one family. Mm-hmm. And one cow can last you a good while. Now, the way that I would like to eat, it would last maybe a year.
Yeah.
But that's going, well, we're moving towards evolution talking now.
Which is perfect. Let's get going on it. Evolution. What are your thoughts?
Before I get into that, part of it is just, to me, the proper human diet is an animal-based paleo diet. You can have a plant-based paleo diet. I think that is incongruent with evolution. Evolution shows us as animal-based. Mm-hmm. Now, evolution is controversial within the church. It's controversial within America. I think it's interesting. I don't know if you know N.T. Wright, but he's a Anglican, I think, bishop, maybe no longer. I don't remember. But he's a big, big guy over in England. He was asked this, and he's like, I don't understand this. It's an American problem. We have no issue with evolution in Europe.
Really?
It is an American problem. We're the ones that really started it, and that's where fundamentalism, it's more entrenched in America than it is elsewhere. I'm sure it is elsewhere.
Yeah.
But it's much more entrenched here for issues with evolution and creationism. And so I used to be a creationist. That's the way I viewed things, because that's the way I thought scriptures read. I thought it, you took it that way. And that's what I was taught. That's what I heard. It's what Elder McConkie, President Joseph Fielding Smith, that's what seemingly the church supported. That's what the old Institute manual for the Old Testament. It's what it still teaches. And I think that's still technically the current edition. But I didn't know about the arguments that were within amongst the brethren when it came to this. I didn't know anything about that. I thought what we had is what we had, and whether it was stated or not. I remember having an Institute class at LDS Business College taught by a guy that I still admire. He's a wonderful teacher. He's retired now, but he said, I'm going to do this whole class. I'm going to read a bunch of quotes. You're not allowed to ask questions. You're just allowed to listen. And it's because of all the flack around this. And he taught that evolution was false. And he taught that, quoted Brigham Young and others, talking about how Adam and Eve's bodies were created just like anyone else's bodies, only by God. And so we had a completely physical link to God through Adam and Eve, in that it was literally 6 days, 6,000 years, that sort of thing. So yeah, that's just how I believed it. But then it doesn't match with anything in science. And so the only thing that makes sense is there's a huge conspiracy theory by all scientists trying to destroy religion. And that's all that there is. Except the evidence is so freaking strong. And that's the problem. And that's where we're seeing people, unfortunately, leave the, not just the church, the Christian church completely. They're just seeing people leave because they hit college. They're going to inevitably to be taught evolution in some class. And then they're going to realize this doesn't match and something's wrong here. And so they throw the baby out with the bathwater, or they dig in their heels and go in opposite direction, which I would say that the former is much more likely.
Yeah.
It just creates a huge problem. And it's sad to me, because now that I have come to terms with it, it's so much more beautiful, in my opinion. Part of the coming to terms with it, so, and we don't have to get off on the tangent to the Book of Mormon geography, but that's probably where I started coming to terms. I was always this curious and thought it was fun. It was more of just a side hobby with Book of Mormon geography. So if I could find some YouTube videos, I would go and watch them. I got the quotes from Joseph Smith about the Plains of the Nephites or Zelph or any of those things that are just interesting. And, you know, you just kind of match things up the way that you can. And I always kept it very loose and open because I wasn't sure. But it seemed to me that like Heartland was more correct just from the quotes that I had. And so at some point, some family members and whatnot were getting into Heartland. I started going, okay, let me look into this actually a little bit more legitimately instead of casually watching a YouTube video. And the guy on YouTube, like, he seemed, you know, pretty good. He It's an supposed archaeologist. I say supposed. He never finished his degree. And it was very fascinating. And so I was like, okay, maybe there's some truth here. And so I went to a Heartlanders conference in Kansas City because it was just free and the temple's there for us. So I went up there to go to the temple, and then we went to the Heartland conference. And it was interesting. I was very open at the time to all sorts of different things. And there was a guy presenting on some more spiritual healing aspects that I thought was interesting, but it's just, it gets way weird. So I just left that one go. But anyways, they were sharing stuff, and they invited him to come down to Arkansas to talk, which would be fun for you to have him on the podcast if he's willing, Rod Meldrum.
Oh yeah.
Came down to Arkansas and talked. Super nice guy. They're all nice. Like, they're just good people. They just have very strong opinions. Mm-hmm. And so he started talking about, anti-evolution stuff and sharing the universal model, which, yeah, interesting. Which I was open to that too. I don't know anything about geology. It's not my thing. I was just like, oh, this is interesting. I'm a very open person. So, you just share something. I'm like, I'm going to look at it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be curious about it. And so they shared the Book of Mormon annotated edition, which is one of their things that they brought up. And I was like, really liking it. And most of the time they shared how everyone's against them and academics are against them. And that doesn't help when you're in the chiropractic world and the natural functional medicine world where medicine is against you.
Yeah.
So now you're seeing another group with like-minded things. Oh, they're against them too. They must be right. And so I ignored a lot of the scholars who were scoffing at them because some of them were rude in how they scoffed at them, but they were also just, they're young. A lot of the scholars that were scoffing at them. And so finally, I humbled myself enough to take a look at what one of them had to say, and he ripped it apart. None of the evidence matched. In fact, one of the things that they tried to show was that they found a giant skeleton. There's a guy who was an Irishman with gigantism who died in the 1800s, and that was the skeleton. And it's in the annotated Book of Mormon. And that's just another one of the millions of issues with that book. And it's really sad. And so when I finally looked at it, it all came crashing down in that realm. I was like, yeah, you guys, nope, I'm done. And then, of course, they became really, really political, really weird political. And I was like, nah, I'm definitely done. So left that behind. But that's when, along that time period, that's when evolution started coming to a head. It's something I just couldn't ignore anymore. Yeah. It was in the back burner of my head. I knew it needed to be addressed. I would watch creation videos. I have a good friend who's more on the creation side of things, and he sent me videos. And you'd watch like the Ken Ham versus Bill Nye debate, which was a worthless debate because neither of them have credentials that are needed. I mean, Bill Nye's a mechanical engineer. No offense to engineers, but but not an evolutionary biologist.
Right.
And then Ken Ham, I'm not sure what his expertise is, but it wasn't in that field. And so you're just getting these guys just talking about random things that really aren't good for a debate. And whether you're cheering for one side or the other, doesn't really matter. Finally, I came to terms with it, started reading a lot of Ben Spackman stuff. His was probably one of the big ones that helped me because he shared how you should interpret the Bible and how they would have read it. What is the original intent of the author? Has nothing to do with science. And why would it? Pete Enns is one of my favorite scholars that's out there. He's an evangelical scholar. But one of the things that he said, two of them, one of them was, God lets his children tell his story for him. Love that phrase, because all of a sudden, all the problems with the Old Testament go away. If you got an issue with the Old Testament and you think God is different, meaning he's a God of love as represented in the person of Jesus Christ, then there's something incongruent with the Old Testament stories. Mm-hmm. And most likely we're seeing a filter through the people of the time.
That makes sense.
So I love that. And then another thing Pete Enns said was, it is sheer Western arrogance to think that a people that were 4,000 or 5,000 years removed, God would reveal to them what only us Westerners today would understand. Why would he share with them something from a scientific standpoint that we would understand only.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense. And that's the same with the word of wisdom. That's the same with anything else. It's line upon line, principle upon principle. And I don't think we take that verse serious enough. God reveals a little bit at a time. And I mean, President Nelson's been constant with that lately. It's been so much on this idea of the restoration is ongoing. Things are continuing to be revealed. And there's so much more to be revealed. I mean, we think of what was given in the Old Testament versus now. We like to think that everything we have now was given to Adam and Eve or to Abraham or something like that. But no, that's not what happened. They revealed a little bit. Or like the brother of Jared. I love the book of Ether because it doesn't mention anything about the gospel in it. It doesn't mention priesthood. The only thing it really has is that they believed in the Lord and followed his commandments. Yep. And that Jesus was revealed to the brother of Jared at one point. And I think that's fascinating. And we just overlooked that. And so with evolution, so that all came to a head. And finally, reading through Spackman stuff, reading through other things, one of the big ones was Henry Eyring. I love Henry Eyring's works.
Me too. Yep.
Reading Reflections of a Scientist is what changed my mind. And I think that's where anyone who's anti-evolution will have a hard time arguing. Or at least anti-age of the earth being more than 6,000 years. Like, I think that's the most beautiful thing with Henry Eyring is just like, when he admits that, he's like, if the age of the earth isn't 4.5 billion years old, the things I do as a chemist would not work. And there's so much like that goes into the dating of the earth and the accuracy of that, you know, with geology and with metallurgy and chemistry, that it just wouldn't work. And he just lays it out so beautifully and humbly. That's like the thing I love most about Henry Eyring. It's like when he talks about evolution, he's like, it is a very beautiful theory. It's wonderful. Now, he uses theory. Most of us misunderstand that word. And that drives me insane. Well, it's just a theory. No, you're thinking hypothesis. That's very different. Drives me insane. But anyways, his book's monumental in changing my opinion on that. And finally, I could let go of that. My foundation didn't fall apart and I didn't, like, the house of cards came down. I just had to replace the foundation. Mm-hmm. And once I replaced the foundation, it's, to me, so much more beautiful. Yeah. Like, evolution is wonderful. So like the guy I messaged you earlier, Heath Ogden, some great videos by the guy. Or Reconciling Evolution from BYU, from their biology department. Awesome videos from them. I think her name's Jamie Jensen. I can't remember off the top of my head. She's an evolutionary biologist at BYU and helps people reconcile not just Latter-day Saints, but evangelicals, Muslims, others, reconcile their beliefs. And it's so wonderful. So that brings us to evolution.
Yeah.
In a roundabout long way, right?
Right.
So I think one of the posts that we really started chatting about too was a, I can't remember the author's name. He's out of University of Tel Aviv. You remember his name?
Oh, Ben something, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but
yeah,
he just finished his PhD not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote this article on what the human diet was for 2 million years. So with human diet, of course, we're not talking about Homo sapiens alone. We're talking about the entire, hominid group of primates. So it goes back to Homo habilis, Homo erectus. I can't remember off the top of my head. It's been too long.
I think
Homo erectus was like 2 million years. But anyways, we track that far back, and apparently it's even further back now. Like, fire apparently is tracked back 3 or 4 million years.
Oh, really?
It's pretty crazy. How far we track that back. But about 2 million years ago is where we really see things changing. But for a good 2 million to 2.5 million years, humans were hypercarnivores. And now a hypercarnivore, by definition, is somebody that eats 70 or gets 70% of their calories from meat or animal products. It is not like what we typically think with 100%, like if a carnivore, that's all they eat.
Right.
Meat. It's not really what that is. It's 70%. And so we do know that is a big, big reason why we evolved big brains, or at least helped us to be capable of developing. According to a guy I was listening to yesterday, Bill Schindler, we still don't know why, but we do know that without the needed nutrients from organs, from fat, from meat, from hunting and fire, we would not have been able to develop it, because that was kind of the building blocks that led to it. Of course, he shares the stoned ape theory as a possibility, which we can get into that later if we want to.
Yeah.
But I still think that it's fascinating that 70% for over 2 million years, that's the amount of calories that came from animals. And then when we start thinking about that, and how I kind of explain to all my clients now, I'm like, imagine you're out in the wilderness. You have no food with you. You're out in the woods here in the Ozarks where I live. What is it you're going to be able to eat? What is the most bang for your buck benefit? And I said, you might find some mushrooms if it's in the season. Of course, you have to have the knowledge to know which ones to eat.
Yep. Prudence.
Yeah, prudence, exactly. They might find some sorrel, some wood sorrel, but that's what, half a calorie and a handful? I don't even know how many calories, probably hardly anything. Berries or maybe pawpaw, which now I'm afraid of pawpaw. I did not know how poisonous those seeds were. Like, you nick a seed and you get just a little bit of it, you're going to be diarrhea and vomiting. You eat a whole seed or two, you could die. Mm. I did not know that. But you might find a pawpaw, you might find blackberries, but that's only in their season, and it's a very short season. So the best bang for your buck is animals, 100%. So if we're going to find food, it's going to be in animals. Now, people like to try to go, well, look to our primate cousins, like the chimpanzee or the gorillas. They are primarily foragers, mainly. Like, they don't really eat that many bugs or meat or anything like that. They're primarily foragers, but they also have an incredibly different digestive tract, very long, large intestine, and allows them to ferment their food into short chain fatty acids for them to absorb. So very different in how they go about things. And that's all they do all day long is eat. So, I mean, the amount of chewing is ridiculous that they would have to go through. And so for us, we have, I think it's pretty strong evidence, and it seems to get stronger and stronger as the years go on, that it's animal foods. And then all that comes to a head and changes as the mass extinction starts. Now, it might not be the only reason, but it is definitely a huge factor. Around 50 to 80,000 years ago, there was a mass extinction, most of it pointing to over hunting, that we hunted too much. I would assume at some point with the Ice Age, unless that Lance guy's right, I don't know. Yeah. Could be. It's interesting, though.
Very interesting.
But there could have been some other catastrophes at the time that went to the extinction of the megafauna. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, they don't know that there were huge animals all over the world, and most of them went extinct around that time period, or at least up to that time period. So not just mastodons, not just mammoths and that sort, but other ones, like there's the giant sloth here in America. One of the other ones, I can't remember the top of my head.
Giant beavers.
Yeah, giant beavers, crazy stuff.
Giant everything.
But that stuff was plethora. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
And then they went extinct. And so there was a massive shift from there. There's another massive shift, according to one scholar that he's purporting, that might be even more significant, is religion. That religion led to the more of a civilization rather than a nomadic group, and for them to cultivate crops, because we think of the agricultural revolution as the change, and that is the absolute change, and that happened, you know, 10 to 15,000 years ago is when it really came to a head. And we think, well, humans started tilling the earth. So they realized, oh, I can plant the seed and grow my own food. Well, according to recent research, that isn't the reason. It wasn't for food. It was for brewing of alcohol for ritual purposes. And that's where the earliest temple that we have, Göbekli Tepe, comes in. And so it seems like ritual, religious aspects is what brought us into the agricultural revolution. Now, there's a lot of good that comes from the agricultural revolution, but from a health standpoint, it's bad. And so we see a complete decline in health. We see dental caries, we see malformations, we see a shorter stature, a smaller brain size, bone issues. So all sorts of issues. Chronic disease comes on, especially in societies that tend to be more grain-based. We start seeing diabetes, we start seeing obesity and other things. Depends on the class and how much money you had and whatnot and how poor you were. But we started seeing a massive shift. And yes, there's a huge argument against the Paleolithic people. They all died at 40 years old and that sort of stuff. But when you take out warfare, you take out infection, and you take out child mortality, they live to 80 years old, just like we do.
Yeah.
And that's the same argument in the 1800s when people like to say, well, the life expectancy during that time was horrible. Well, it is horrible when you take into account that child mortality was 50%. Mm-hmm. So you remove that, you remove the infectious disease, and all of a sudden people are living long lives. And they always had been, as long as they didn't, you know, drink some poisoned water or get into a battle or fall off a cliff and hurt themselves or something. So yeah, that's kind of the evolution aspect. And so from a dietary aspect with health, we try to go back to what our ancestors would have ate, because our genetics are not different from our hunter-gatherer ancestors. It hasn't been long enough evolutionarily for us to mutate and change along those lines genetically. And so an animal-based diet is generally what we should be eating. We should be eating more what they did, which is nose to tail, animal-based with some fruit, some in their season, with some vegetables that we can find here and there, in their season again, and cutting out the seeds, not to eat any seeds. That's a huge one. Seeds overall, well, actually, let's just get into that. So vegetables, the whole idea of prudence, why we brought that up a couple of times, is plants cannot run away from you. And as the guy I listened to last night, Bill Schindler, so he has a book coming out called Eat Like a Human, but he's an archaeologist. But he said, plants should scare the heck out of you. I've made that a little better.
Censored it a little bit.
Censored it. Yeah. But plants should scare the heck out of you.
Yeah.
And the reason they should scare the heck out of you is because they have toxins in them for defense. And that is why our ancestors fermented. That's why they sprouted. That's why they soaked. That's why they went through several different processes depending on the food they're eating. So grains were always soaked, sprouted, and fermented. We don't do any of that unless you're knowledgeable on that aspect. Legumes, same type of thing. They go through quite a bit of process. But let's talk about legumes, grains, nuts. They're all seeds. And if we think about a seed, seeds are meant for planting. It's the propagation of their seed, perpetuation of them. And so they don't want you to eat them and consume them. So they're going to have toxins in them. And so they're meant to be planted. They're not meant to be consumed. And then when we talk about other things like leaves, roots are the storage capacity for a plant. They also don't want you to eat that because it'll kill them. They don't want you to eat their leaves because that's how they make their energy from the sun. Fruit is the difference there. Fruit, whether it's non-sweet fruit like a cucumber or a zucchini, or sweet ones like apples or bananas, plants want you to eat them. And so if we eat them, we're going to pass along their seed. They make it sweet for us. And that's when we know it's ripe, tastes good. Then we can go and, you know, whether excrete through our bowel movement the seed or we remove the seeds and throw them away. Now, the one caveat there is nightshades, so peppers, tomatoes, and that sort of thing. There's a lot of toxins in those. But that's kind of the general idea of prudence with plants, is they can hurt us. Yeah. And I mean, I was just watching a video today about oxalates. I don't know if you're familiar with oxalates.
A little bit.
But so oxalates are in several different types of foods, especially like spinach, turmeric, kale, a lot of different foods, almonds is another one. but they can jack you up pretty good too, especially if you have kidney likelihood of kidney stones. They're the number one cause to kidney stones. So that's another huge aspect of toxins in plants that can go to our detriment. Whereas when we look at meat, you don't get any of those. You just hunt them and you can eat them. And in fact, with organs, if it's a fresh kill, you can probably eat them raw. And a lot of people do around the world. They eat them raw. Yeah. And that's important aspect. It's nose to tail. Organs are the number one prized food amongst all indigenous people and traditional cultures, is what I mean.
Yeah.
So like the Hadza in Africa, Maasai, though the Maasai have a unique way of doing things. They drink the blood of their cows and milk and things of that sort. But organs are the number one prize. Like Mongolia, Mongolia is a good example. Organs are the top dog, then meat. Sometimes they'll even throw the meat to the dogs because it's just not worth it to them. Organs are the most nutrient dense food on the planet. So we look at liver. I always explain this too. It's like, if I was to hold a liver, I'll sometimes use a piece of steak to really drive the point home with my patients. But I'm like, if I hold a piece of liver in my hand versus kale, kale is the superfood that everyone loves. And I mean, it doesn't have to be kale. It could be acai, which is also a superfood people love, all sorts of different things. So I'm like, which one has the most nutrients? Liver wins hands down. There's no contest. There's not a vegetable out there that comes close to what liver can do for us. And so, yeah, that's essentially the animal-based diet. It's very strong on animal foods, especially from ruminants. And then it comes to fruits, vegetables, properly prepared grains and vegetables, both technically. But you just got to be careful with that sort of things. So you need to know your body, especially if you have symptoms. So yeah, that's animal-based diet and evolution.
Love it.
And that's how I try to eat. Of course, sometimes I don't do the best with that because sometimes it can be a little costly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually kind of eat an animal-based diet. But for me, it, so I don't know. I guess I'll tell a little bit of my story. I don't know if you've heard it, but about,
I think you told me a little bit of it.
Yeah. Starting in about 2016, I had like just graduated from college. I got a job, and then all of a sudden, like, my health went like downhill really fast. I was getting like really like bad IBS, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, like, yep, just out of nowhere. And I would get pain in my wrists, and I would get pain in my ankles. Some days I'd wake up and I'd get out of bed and it felt like I'd sprained my ankle in my sleep. And wow. I know for sure that I hadn't done anything in my sleep, right? Like, I was like, okay. And so I would limp through work like the whole day and just be like, I don't know what the deal is. And there are some other things too. Those are the biggest things. There's a lot of pain in the bowel area and in the joints and my knees, mm-hmm, too. My knees would hurt. I'd play basketball every once in a while, and then my knee would hurt for like a week, you know? And my initial thought was, hey, maybe I'm not living the word of wisdom well enough, you know? And so I looked into those.
Too much meat, man.
Yeah. Like that, you know, the whole gout thing. So my friend told me, maybe it's gout. Like, maybe that's why your foot hurts. You eat too much
meat. Oh, that one kills me.
Right. And I was like, wow, I don't know. I don't eat that much meat, but. And so I was like, well, maybe I need to kind of go plant-based. I tried that for a week just for an experiment. I did feel a little bit better, but I did end up eating a lot of like pasta and bread because it's like, how do I find plants to eat like all week long and no meat, you know?
And for it to be filling. Yeah, it's super hard.
Yeah. And so I kind of went off of that. It took me a while to kind of realize. I watched a documentary about wheat. And how wheat can be really harmful and gluten and all that. And I thought maybe that's the deal. And so I cut that out. It helped a ton. But it didn't fix everything. Right. And so this is a process of like 2.5 years or so. And then finally, like the start of 2020 ish, about my wife and I had made a ton of changes. Like we're using cleaner ingredients in everything. We get things that are less toxic to clean the house, like better soap, shampoo, like toothpaste, everything. Like we're making a lot of changes, right? 2020 comes around and like things shut down. You tell me where to find some real milk online, and I find that, and then I kind of get into this animal-based way of things because I've realized a lot of the plants I'm eating kind of hurt me. The wheat, I can't eat wheat that well, and so I'm going to stay off of that. And so this milk and like a bunch of animal foods, and I feel great. Like the summer of 2020 when everything shut down, I was like, it's like the healthiest I've ever been, you know? Like
people, life is good.
Yeah. And it's crazy. And I attribute part of that to you for helping me to find that milk, because I think that helped a lot.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah.
And so whether evolution is true or not, it seems like you're saying that humans have evolved to eat mostly animal products. And from my personal experience, I do feel better when I eat mostly animals.
And I think that's 100% right.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to write an article on the proper human diet here soon for my website.
Yeah.
And that's part of the way I'm going to word it is just like whether, I know this is a controversial topic. So whether you want to say we're evolved or you want to say that we're, I'll probably say evolved and designed. I believe it's both. But it doesn't really matter. Our genetics show that this is the way we should be eating, or at least our ancestral development. This is the way we should be eating. When we look to the way that certain ancestors lived, however you want to say whether we evolved from them or not, the ones who were the healthiest were animal-based. And I think that's the most important thing. That is what I try to do. I started first with paleo, and then I moved towards this as the evidence mounted. And it was reluctant. I didn't want to admit that this was correct. But the evidence was strong. It's so strong. Part of it was Paul Saladino's book that I read, and I thought he did an excellent job. And he's much more strict in the book than he really is. And part of the reason he's that strict is because eczema was so bad for him that the only way that he could fix it was go completely carnivore. I mean, he ate nothing but meat and salt, and that's it. I did that for a month. I didn't remove dairy. I know I don't have a dairy issue. So I kept eating dairy, and I did feel better. Partially because nightshades are a problem for me and I don't want to believe it still because I like French fries, dang it.
Same. Yeah, same way.
Yeah. I just don't want to admit it. But it's hard. The hardest thing with nightshades is gluten, it can get out of your body in a couple of weeks. Nightshades, the neurotoxin in there, solanine, it has a half-life of 1 to 2 months.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it can be 6 months before you get it out of your system. Wow. So to see the benefit, sometimes it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. And so if you make a mistake, it starts all over again and it sucks. And so these are foods that we commonly eat and enjoy. And we enjoy a lot of foods in social gatherings. And I think that's super, super important. Humans have always kind of came together in social gatherings with food. And so food is part of entertainment. It's part of family gatherings. It's part of community. So to get rid of that aspect, I think, is damaging. So we have to find a way through that. And so I'll still eat like white rice. I'll still eat certain things because I know it's not messing with me. But at times I don't, because I'll notice maybe some blood sugar problems or whatever. And I'm still working through other issues. Like mold has been a constant problem for me. It seems like every place I've lived, I've had mold issues. So they cause different types of headaches. Like I've counted maybe 4 or 5 headaches that I get, not just migraines. But overall, I'm healthier than I've ever been. And I'm finally back to lifting weights. For a long time, I was exercise intolerant. I just couldn't handle it. Partially because I didn't eat enough. That's always helpful. But there's just so much to it. And I think anyone who switches to, and I say animal-based, I don't think carnivore. I disagree with that one. I think some people have to, just like a bell curve. There's an extreme. That's the only thing they handle. Like Jordan Peterson or his daughter, Michaela, it seems like that's the only thing that works for them.
Yeah.
And if that's what works, that's what works. But I think animal-based paleo is probably the closest, which is generally what Paul Saladino says too. I don't think he would want anyone to say that he's the absolute right on all of these things, because he's constantly evolving with his ideas too. But we're all evolving in that standpoint together thinking about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's evolution, food, animal-based diet. And yeah, that's what I recommend to my clients. I know a lot of doctors disagree with it, but the evidence, it's not just the evidence from scientific research showing that's the way we eat. It's the evidence of people getting better, and they do so much better. We are protein deficient in America. And I've gotten into arguments with people about this, but it is absolutely written in the literature. When we look at old folks' homes, unfortunately for like retirement homes and nursing homes, sarcopenia is really, really bad. So that's muscle wasting. So that's a huge problem. And when we look around the country of what they're recommending for protein, it's so low. Protein is the building block of life. We have to have protein. And we're generally getting like 50 grams or under per day. We're not really getting a lot. And I might be overestimating that. But what we should be getting is closer to 1 gram per pound ideal weight. So if your ideal weight, yeah, ideal body weight. Yeah. So if your ideal weight is 120 pounds, you should be getting 120 grams of protein. For me, I'm closer to 175, 180. I need about that much per day. And you definitely need that as you get 40, 50 years old, 60 years old, because you don't absorb protein as well. Mm-hmm. And you must have it. You must at least get 3 grams, if I remember correctly, of leucine to kick on protein synthesis. And that's an amino acid that you need about 40 grams of protein to hit. And so that should happen first thing in the morning. You get 40 grams of protein. That should be the number one thing when you break your fast, whether it's breakfast or lunch. It should be protein. And that lines you up for the day. It helps with so many things. I mean, we can go off forever on this.
Yeah.
It's so helpful. But I mean, that can lead us into the fall, though.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, just before we do that real quick, thanks for sharing all that stuff. I don't know, I don't want to like bear my testimony about the animal-based diet, but I know that it's worked for me, and I feel great. Like, I don't get joint pain. I don't get IBS unless I start to eat some of those things, right? Yep. Like, I'll still eat an occasional cookie, you know, and like, I'll still eat, you know,
thankfully, there's good paleo cookies out there, right?
True.
They're not that great for you though.
No. Like, I'm not 100%, but I know that, like, if I were to look at how I was eating 5 years ago and compare it with today, it'd be drastically different, right? And I still eat food that tastes good. Like, I'm not just eating celery in a dark corner and just, like, wishing I had something better, you know?
Exactly. Like, it's a good diet. It tastes good.
Yeah.
So, I think if it tastes bad, you're not going to do it.
Right. Yeah.
It's like exercise. If you don't like it, you're not going to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyways, thank you. Thanks for talking about that.
No problem.
So yeah, you're saying that evolution is probably the way that it happened. And there's a lot of reasons why that kind of conflicts with anyone kind of religious, and especially the Latter-day Saints. What about the fall? What about Adam and Eve? Like, can you tell, what do you think? What about this stuff?
And it's funny, like, you know, especially with Latter-day Saints, it's sad to me because Elder Talmage was okay with it, or at least partially okay. He was definitely okay with the age of the earth. Elder Woodsow was okay with it. President McKay was seemingly okay with it from his statements. And it's even interesting from the one that most people quote, Joseph Fielding Smith. He was totally okay with BYU teaching evolution. So, I mean, these guys control, like the Brethren control what happens at BYU, or at least are very significantly involved, and that was okay. And so we somehow create this weird tradition that it's not okay, and that the official position of the church is anti-evolution, even though the official position isn't. It has no official position. It leaves it to the scientists. Right. And it really comes down to interpretation of scripture. So we care why it happened. We don't care how it happened. And that's the original intent of scripture, is why the creation, not how it happened. And we like to conflate the two. Of course, when we read scripture, we're trying to conflate it with, or mix it up with science. So concordism. And sometimes I'll fall into that still because I'm still wondering and speculating and having fun. Because I truly wonder, like Jordan Peterson talks about it, that it's like echoes of the past, that it's in their culture and it's in their cultural memories. And they're bringing up some of these aspects because meaning is so deeply involved. And this is something that Peterson said at one point. We care so much about what about matter, but we care very little about what matters. And he argues that what matters matters more. Yeah. And so that's meaning. And I wrote a little thing yesterday because I'd like to write a personal blog on this of just meaning in general and how if we strip away stories and meaning from the world, we strip away what matters most. We end up with just something hollow. All you have is, I mean, you look up at the night sky, all of us have awe and grandeur when we look up at the night sky. But if we all we think about is all those are just giant gas balls with no purpose, and we just strip it down to just the material aspect, we lose so much. Right. And it's the story, it's the meaning that drives us. And I think psychologists have really kind of pointed to that, that we're driven to be religiously minded. Jordan Peterson says that, but so does Jonathan Haidt, another big social psychologist. They talk about how our minds are kind of uniquely evolved to that, to look for meaning and religion, religious aspects and things. And so the fall, there's several things that I've come up with the fall because as Christians, everyone kind of focuses on the fall. Jews don't really. It's not really something they care about. They don't like, you bring it up to them, they wouldn't even know what you're talking about unless they're familiar with Christianity. Really came to a head with Augustine. Augustine's the one that really kind of solidified the fall more than anyone. So what is it meant by the fall? What is the doctrine of the fall? And is Adam and Eve real? Or are they real? I think they are. I think there's enough evidence from Revelations to Joseph Smith that they were real people. But I highly question the story of Genesis is their story. I do not think it's their story. I think they were used as representatives of humankind. Further, I think we mistranslate Genesis 1 and 2 when it does talk about Adam and Eve. They're not proper names. It should say human and life. It shouldn't say Adam and Eve. And that is a huge mistake from translation. And so it's talking about all of us. It's representative of us. It's an archetypal story. And when we realize it's our story, then we start understanding, oh, I'm the actor here. I'm the one playing this role. I'm the one that's partaking of the fruit. I'm the one that's naked in the garden and becomes shameful. That's what the temple technically says too. It talks about that we are representing Adam and Eve in that sense.
Yeah, I was just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's a drama, and we're actors in the drama, and that's what temples were. They were ancient dramas. They were the theaters in that sense. And so what really is going on with the fall? I think there's the idea, and I don't think this would accord with Genesis, though. It would only accord with restoration, maybe with Christianity, is the idea of premortal life, us coming into mortality, and that's the fall. So we have that descent. I think it's still true, especially because the restoration's ongoing. So maybe the Lord is changing our viewpoint here to help us to go, no, the fall has more to do with this, and that maybe the garden is actually heaven, is symbolic of heaven. Yeah. Maybe. The other one is from James Kugel, who's an Orthodox Jew. He wrote a book on how to read the Bible. Really, really good read. I still need to actually go and finish it, but I read the beginning parts of Genesis, and he talks about that it might be the hunter-gatherer going to the agricultural revolution, going through it and becoming farmers. And that was the fall, because it talks about, I think, tilling the earth in the way that they look at it, going from wild to domestication type of thing.
Yeah,
and I thought that was interesting. Another guy, Joshua James Vanney, I think is his name, or Joshua Vanney. I can't remember his name right off the hand. But he talks about that subdue and dominion means hunter and gatherer. essentially they're going out and subduing their dominion, which is often used in warfare in the Old Testament, is that they're going out and killing these animals, and that it's actually about hunting. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And then the other one has more to do with a lot, and I think this is the one I buy into the most, is that the traditional thing is a cultural memory of our transition from apes to hunter-gatherers to farmers. And that it was a slow progression of us becoming aware of our own consciousness and what to do with that. Because when we look at the tree of knowledge of good and evil, it is your understanding that what I do has consequences. So if I hurt this person, I can legitimately hurt them. If I do something to them, I can legitimately hurt them. So it's understanding that my actions can cause evil and good, and knowing that it will cause evil and good. And so that is an awareness, or a coming to a consciousness that animals don't have. So it's our progression in evolution to understanding that and becoming aware. And that's what the tree of knowledge of good and evil symbolizes, is us becoming aware. And I mean, there's a whole lot of symbolism there that's beautiful. Like the snake. The snake symbolizes time. Is it Ouroboros, I think, is it? Where the snake eating its tail. Mm. And so that represents time. And so it's this boundary that we have, that now we're aware of time. Whereas all other animals aren't aware of time. We're aware of time, though. We know that we will die at some point. And the snake is a good symbol of that, because for our primate ancestors, the snake was a danger. It was a huge danger. And from what we can tell, and what evolutionary biology is showing us, that our eyes picking up color developed so we could recognize snakes.
Oh, really?
And so that's actually a huge aspect there. So we were able to quickly tell. And I mean, primates are horribly afraid of snakes.
Yeah.
You can go on YouTube and look at some fun things with chimpanzees and snakes and stuff. But that might be that representation. And it also might be the representation of us descending from the tree to the plains.
Yeah.
And that's when things really start to take off, because then we find that we can hunt. We find that we're strong, that we can take down animals. We first started as scavengers. We were probably very much watching the scavengers, eating meat and that sort of things. And so we figured out how to do that, because we did, from my understanding, we did start as scavengers, and we developed tools. And then once you have a tool, you can take down an animal and you can eat it. And so that became the groups of tribal groups going out and hunting clans. And I think that's fascinating. And then the more meat they ate, the more organs they made, learned how to make fire, exponential increase in brain size. And a lot of the guys out there talk about how crazy that evolved, that it should have taken longer, apparently. I don't know if that's true. But either way, our brain size exponentially increased when we learned to walk upright and hunt. Of course, that's where stoned ape theory comes in.
Oh, stoned ape theory. Okay.
Which is a fascinating one.
I do want you to talk about that for a second, because I know very little about that. But just really quick, like what you said, that Jordan Peterson said, that meaning is so important and we shouldn't take the meaning out of things. I think that's beautiful, right? Jordan Peterson has a lot of great stuff. That's beautiful.
I feel like he's underrepresented and often mischaracterized.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. And then all those, like, I'm geeking out about this, because the fall, all those examples that you gave, like maybe it means this or this or this, maybe it means all of them, you know? Yeah. And it's just, good. Like, that's just how beautiful symbolism is, and the meaning, like Jordan Peterson's talking about, that we should find meaning in everything. And I think there's a lesson to learn in our life too. Like, let's not take the meaning out of our life. Like, let's not take the meaning out of having dinner with our family or playing outside in the grass. Like, I don't know. It's just beautiful. I just had that thought. I thought I should share it. So
no, 100%. I love that. We shouldn't take the meaning out of that. That's become, you know, for a while I felt bad if I read a fantasy novel, because I felt like, oh, I got so many books I got to read. But now, understanding meaning, fantasy novels are nothing but the hero's journey over and over again. And there's so much meaning there. Mm-hmm. And I had a hard time with that. Now I came to terms. I'm like, no, I love it. And some of these other things that we'll get into later, but there's just so much meaning and depth if we can just open our eyes. Let him who has eyes, or whatever the scripture is.
Wow,
that's great. That's the fall, but so stoned ape theory. So the idea came from Terence McKenna. I have a hard time listening to you. He's all over the place with his thoughts. And it's very controversial. It's very controversial. And I am not saying that this is something I hold to strongly. I think the evidence is becoming more and more clear. And that's not necessarily for the stoned ape theory, but just in general for this. But the idea is when they came to the savannah, got down from the trees and started hunting on the savannah, they would come across poop. And one of the number one things that grows on poop in Africa is a psilocybin mushroom. And if they were to eat that, they would go on a psychedelic trip. And that the stoned ape theory is the idea that that is, or I guess hypothesis, is the idea that eating the mushroom is what triggered the consciousness to grow and the brain to grow. And then the meat and the fat and that sort of thing, the organs, is what supplied the needed nutrition to grow the brain. So it's a really interesting hypothesis. I don't know if it's true.
Right.
I could see it being true just with the new research that's coming out. Like I think psilocybin, there was a mushroom study out of Johns Hopkins showing that it's creating new neural connections. Fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, neurogenesis is a difficult thing to do. And for a long time, we didn't believe it was possible. And now we're seeing neurogenesis with psychedelic mushrooms. Fascinating. And then, of course, the evidence, what I was speaking of, that's really strong is pretty much every single ritual, religious activity seems to be strongly connected to a psychedelic herb, mushroom, whatever, what have it. And we even have, I think last year, one of the temples, the pre-exilic temples before Josiah mandated all temples to be only one temple in Jerusalem. So before that, there were many temples in Israel. And one of the temples was excavated and they found cannabis amongst the altar of incense. So that's one of the big ones that they recently found. There's a bunch of evidence all over the place from different religions, rituals, and so on. And several people arguing that that is strongly connected with all religions, including Christianity.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So do you think that our evolutionary ancestors eating these mushrooms might have like played a role in the development of religion? Like is this part of the fall where our eyes were opened and we started to realize consequences and that there was more to life? What do you think?
That's what McKenna says. And I think that's interesting. I mean, I can't quote the guy as a credible scholar on this aspect. But he held strongly that that's the fruit of the tree of life, or a tree of knowledge of good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the fruit to be literal.
Right.
But I mean, what if it is? What if it is that? And that's what gave us the awareness. And from that awareness, we learned who God was and slowly developed that. That's the current thinking. And I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating that all religions seem to have a central theme through them. When you look at core doctrines, it's not uncommon to find that love and benevolence is at their center. Mm-hmm. So pretty much all of them, whether it's Taoism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, nature religions, whatever you want to go with, seems to have love at its center and benevolence. Now there's varying doctrines. I'm not saying that all religions are equal, not saying that, but when you compare them, it's fascinating how much there is overlap. And even Joseph Smith said, if we do not go out and seek all truth in the world, we will not come out true Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed very, very open to that stuff. He would be bringing in stuff, listening to various preachers and things. I wonder what it would be like with him living today with the internet and with all the other people that he would have had access to listen to, because there is beauty in Buddhism. There's beauty in Taoism. There's beauty in Islam. There's beauty all over the place. Doesn't mean that they hold the priesthood keys or anything like that. And we can talk about what that even means and what our role is in the world, because it seems abundantly clear from the brethren that we will never be the majority religion in the world, or at least not for a while. Mm-hmm. They talk about us being the leaven that raises nations, and that people all over the world are doing good. And if they're doing good, they're doing God's work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Moroni 7 says. If they lead you towards Christ,
yeah,
then that is of God. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's the fascinating stuff there.
That is fascinating. Are you done talking about the Stone Ape theory? Because I want to talk about...
Yeah. There's not much more I can say there. I think there's some fascinating books out there you can read. Yeah. I have several on my wish list to read. I have no idea what I think about it. I will say a word of caution, though. I've seen people's lives destroyed by this stuff. I'm not like advocating.
Alex. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not advocating for it, but I'm also not advocating. I think that there is value in it. I'm not sure where my opinion is. I'm more on the side that it was probably used quite mm-hmm. frequently, and I have no issue with that. When you look in the Old Testament, they were constantly going into a trance-like state, whether they're using meditation or some other form to get into a trance-like state. Psychedelics are one tool to get into a trance-like state. Meditation's another one. Fasting is another one. There's several ways to get into a trance-like state. And it's clear in the Old Testament they were doing things like that.
Yeah. Very interesting. Cool. So yeah, I wanted to ask you more about that idea that you said from Joseph Smith, that we should learn the good from everyone, like learn the good from the Buddhists, learn the good from the Presbyterians, from the Baptists, come out a true Mormon. I know you wrote a blog post about this on your blog. What more do you have to say about that? Like, what is the importance of this?
So it's like Joseph Smith is the great syncretizer. I think I got the idea first from the Givens, which they've been monumental for me too. Just wonderful, wonderful books that they've written. But Joseph Smith, and I think even what the Temple talks about, that all truth will be circumscribed into one great whole. There's truth all over the place. And Buddhism, so my undergrad's religious studies, and I took a Buddhist class, and there's some fascinating things within Buddhism. One of them is they have a great appreciation for nature, partially because their doctrine of reincarnation. You could be killing, you know, your friend that died yesterday or something like that, or you could be killing a future god, or you could be killing whatever. That causes them to have a beautiful look at creation and nature around them, especially the Zen Buddhists, and maybe even more with Shinto religion in Japan. They have a great care about that. So the idea is that all religions have some aspect of truth, and Buddhism and a lot of their things, it's really good with meditation, which is a beautiful thing, and nature. And I think we don't really care about nature to the degree that we should. I love Joel Salatin, who's a farmer out there. He's a libertarian environmentalist Christian is the way he characterizes himself. Yeah. But he really hits it home with Christians not caring about the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the first commandments we're given, is to take care of the earth, be caretakers of it. So really, really important that we care for the earth. And so that's an important aspect if we don't care for the earth. And so that's part of the syncretization that I think we're needing to look at. We need to, as President Joseph, or not Joseph, David O. McKay called them, the great literature of the past. He called them the minor prophets. So, I mean, we're looking at people like Jane Austen. We're looking at philosophers like Kant or Descartes, or even the older ones like Aristotle, which I love, Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. There is great truth to be had by the great thinkers out there. and we think we have the corner market on truth. We don't. We have the stewardship over the temple, and we have the keys involved there. And that's probably the massive, most important aspect of the church, doing missionary work and doing the work for the dead. But we think we have the corner market, and we don't. And there's so much more out there. I love the Tao Te Ching. That's something that I'm more studying recently, Taoism. And I mean, as one recommendation from you, the Tao of Pooh, great, great book.
Such a good book. Yeah.
There's this great truth to be had there that brings peace and joy to your life that can bring so much happiness. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I think we're getting at. And we need to pull down our walls that we created a long time ago and go out into the world, and we're going to find that it's a beautiful place with a lot of truth. Islam's another big one for me. I met a lot of Muslims on my mission. They are some of the nicest people I have ever met. Hospitality is number one for them. Mm-hmm. And anyone who ridicules them, I generally will push back pretty hard on them because they're some of the best people I've ever met. And there are over 1.5 billion people on this planet. So to say they're all horrible, we got a problem.
Right. Yeah. Well, well said. I can't follow up with anything better than that. So thanks so much. I'll let you go.
No problem, man. Let's definitely another time we can hit the rest of it.
Yeah. For those listening, Gabe and I are constantly messaging each other, and we always talk about the coolest stuff. And he knows so much. He reads so much. He knows so much. So we'll definitely try to get him back on the podcast.
Cool, man. It's been awesome.
Yeah, thank you.